You are not to discuss this matter amongst yourselves.
We don't submit reports or ask approval for specific operations, if that's what you mean. We are an autonomous department.
Any questions?
Podcasting from an abandoned subspace relay orbiting Risa, this is Section 31, gathering intelligence for you on Star Trek CCG. Now reporting in, operatives Dan and Rogue.
Welcome to Section 31, episode number 200, and see, I wrote 37, but I think I got that wrong again.
Yeah, it's got to be 97.
I did the same thing last time. Why am I getting the wrong numbers? Oh, you know what? Because I did exactly the same thing I did last time. I looked at the list, that was the next number, and it's still the wrong number. All right, well, I'm going to figure out what the real number is. Meanwhile, I'm Dan Hammond.
And I am Rogue Schindler.
This week, we will discuss... What are we going to talk about? There were some OTF rule changes that we should probably go over. Maybe we can talk about some of the background on there. We also have a animated series episode to watch. We should talk about that.
Oh, and I went and saw a musical.
Oh.
I think was amazing.
All right. Excellent. Yeah, I see some signatures on there. Did you stay and talk to the cast or what?
I did. Charlie and JD and I made the road trip up, and we knew through a bizarre series of articles and research that there were going to be a few people there. So I bought my Sharpie, and we figured it'll be a fun road trip, and you know. If nothing else, we'll enjoy, talking about the show afterwards or making fun of the show afterwards. And as it turns out, it was the former. We had a great time. It was really funny and surprisingly well done. And through a random stroke of happenstance, the director, and not just guest director, like he is the programmer. Years and years of the Caltech theater program is Brian Brophy, who he's a veteran actor and has been in a lot of random stuff, but you would more readily know him as Commander Bruce Maddox.
Okay.
Of the TNG episode Measure of a Man.
Yeah, sure.
So we all took our little, Maddoxes and got them signed afterwards. He was totally a great sport about it. I talked to him for about 10, 15 minutes about making the show and how it came about. They've been working on it for almost a year now, from a table read workshop into actually putting it on stage. And, wasn't going in with the intention of talking about it, but he asked how we heard about it. And I was like, well, it's funny you mentioned that because I wrote and directed a Star Wars parody musical at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology about 10 years ago. And a friend of mine who knew that saw an article about your show and sent it to me. And I was like, that's next weekend. And I'm totally driving up there for that because that sounds awesome. And there were jokes about Caltech being 10 years behind MIT and then, Star Wars versus Star Trek. And we had some good natured ribbing and some talk about like how they staged it and, you know, getting the guys to write it. It was all original songs, which was in and of itself a really interesting challenge. That was one thing that, I mean, when we did Star Wars, when we wrote our Star Wars musical, we were always like, oh, you know, it'd be fun. We could do a Star Trek musical and this and that. And, you know, those were all sort of passing fancies, but one of the things I always thought would be a challenge with doing the Star Trek musical is there's not, unlike Star Wars, there's like, okay, Star Wars, here's the story. This is the story you're going to tell. These are the characters you're going to tell it with. Star Trek, you either have to pick one episode and hope that people are familiar enough with that one episode out of all of, you know, the hundreds of hours of Star Trek, or you have to come up with your own episode that sure. Still feels like it's Star Trek. And that's what they did. They opted for the latter. It was original series. Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, McCoy, and they did. It felt like an episode of Star Trek, you know, with songs. They did a really great job of capturing the feel of the show thematically, and also performing wise. And the female lead was an Andorian scientist who was, you know, involved with the plot, and she had the shiny silver, you know, 60s costume, and she had a great, she was a phenomenal job of playing the 60s Star Trek guest star, you know, wide-eyed, and I expected the soft focus to come in every shot yeah, every sure. time they did a close-up on her the way they did on the original series. But she did a great reaction shots that way. They had a great the way they staged it. The set was basically a box set, which means the main set was always on stage, which was the bridge. But then they would bring things in front of it to like stage little flats, fronts. So we're like, we're going to bring in these walls and just put it in front of the bridge set. We'll move these consoles forward. They were all rolly, so they can be other consoles. And my favorite part was, they had a dedicated stage, side stage on the front corner that was a step up, and it was decorated to be a transporter pad. And so when they would beam down, they're like, all right, Spock, Bones, you're with me. And they would walk up, and there was a cool lighting effect, and they did the sound effect, and the main stage would go dark, and they kept the lighting effect on the guys, and they were frozen in their transporting pose, and then they would do the set change. And then lights would come up on the main stage, and they would unfreeze, and the transporter lighting would resolve itself, and they would walk out, and it's like, oh hey, we've transported into this new environment.
That is an interesting way of getting around that technological problem. Very good.
Yeah. Really inventive. They had a television, a fairly large flat screen, above the top of the bridge. So anytime they were, talking to Starfleet or the Klingon vessel, the main view screen, they were all still staring, out the fourth wall, but we got to see what they were seeing on the screen above them, which was a nice touch, good way of doing that. So they didn't turn around and look at that screen behind them. It was just sort of for our benefit. And otherwise it just said NCC 1701. It was a really good idea. They, there was an anomaly in the Klingon neutral zone. They had to go investigate. The Andorians science station was the one who picked it up, and that's where they picked up the female professor, because they had to get in, more female leads. So they did a really good job outside of the main cast of filling out the cast with what would otherwise be a very male heavy cast. They go to investigate. Of course, there are Klingons, and they're also detecting this, and they want to find out what's going on. And the Klingon who wanted to be human.
Wait, what?
Or he was like a Klingon who was like obsessed with Federation culture, and he liked to dress like the humans and speak their crazy human language. And they made fun of him for being a toothbrusher and a sandwich eater. And it was a kind of an obvious musical trope, but it was well placed, and it came into play later, which was entertaining. And then the thing that I was most trepidatious about and turned out to be amazing was they had a warp core. So this like cylindrical white screen, which they would roll out center stage when they were in the engineering, and they would shine the lights on it, and it looked like the lava warp core, which was pretty cool. But it also had like half of an octagonal plastic wall around it. And we were all the way on that side, so we saw that as soon as we sat down. And JD looks at me and goes, well, I guess either someone's going to beam up or Spock's dying. And we laughed, and we're like, yeah, okay, And then, spoiler alert, I guess, which is not really relevant because the show's closed already, but they get to the end, towards the end of the show, and They really need to divert the anomaly away from Kronos to save the planet, but the Klingons are attacking because they don't trust them, and it knocks the warp core out of alignment. It can only be realigned minimally, and there's too much radiation. And Spock runs off. And they basically did, you know, the end of Star Trek 2. It was like, okay, Spock reset the warp core that just in time. They were able to divert the asteroid, and Kirk comes down, and they have a song instead of the scene that was probably the best song in the show. I was like, you guys can't do this scene and screw it up. There's just like, they already did that in Into Darkness. It was a little too weird. Right. So yeah, Joe, we walked out and Charlie was like, how did they do that scene better than Into Darkness? But it was really impressive and really heartfelt. It was probably the best song in the show. That or McCoy's Damn It, Jim, I'm a Doctor, which was very close thematically. You know how Weird Al does style parodies? So it's not quite a particular song, but it's definitely that style. Mm-hmm. There was a Modern Major General style, here are all the things I am not because I am a doctor, damn it. which brought the house down. It was very good, and it was in that style. You know, it kept repeating, or it kept accelerating with each repeat of the chorus of each verse, and it got faster and faster. It was really good. But that was a great patter song. But this song was I think even better, and it was great to end the show with that. That was the penultimate song. But then they did a great job of right at the beginning. They had laid in the Andorian professor, who had been studying the anomaly, had installed, you know, had these augmented glandular enhancers that helped her tolerate radiation absorption because of her field of study. And they mentioned it at least twice, maybe three times throughout the show. So you get to the end and Bones is like, oh, wait, let's do a train. You know, normally we wouldn't be able to stop this, but we have these Andorian with these very specific glands, we can do a transplant. You'll lose an antenna, but we might save Spock. And since she was in love with Spock for the whole time, it was a no-brainer. And then, you know, of course he lives because they can't kill him in It's still original series. And then they all live happily ever after. But it was really cool. They did a good job of making it feel like a Star Trek episode. And you know, it turns out neither the Klingons or the Federation were attacking. It was a Romulan plot to get them to go to war, and you know, they came on at the end as the Admiral Barnett, who had been giving them orders via screen before, and then comes on to congratulate them at the end, which was very cool. And man, it was just really it was surprisingly well put together, and it even got better. A lot of shows, a lot of musicals will be really strong for the first act, and then the second act is always shorter because they're trying to resolve everything, and it kind of slows down, or just like, okay, here we go, and we're going to wrap everything up, and here's the end. But this one actually carried through and kept the momentum all the way through, and was a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad that it was the second of the two options that it could have been. You know what I mean?
Yes, as was I. And the cast was really strong. The main leads, Kirk, Spock, and the professor, Andorian professor. It was really refreshing to have the main romantic storyline be Spock instead of Kirk. They had a sort of a side thing with Carol on Earth, being, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm worried about you. Why? You know, it's like, don't worry, everything's going to be A-okay because I'm awesome. I am. What was the name of the song? As Great As I Know I Am.
I can't hear you. Oh, the sound of how awesome I am.
Yep. But then they get to the end, and, you know, Spock almost dies, and Kirk freaks out. So when she comes on at the end, he's like, I'm really sorry. You know, now I understand, having almost lost Spock, what you feel like every time I go out on a mission and face danger. So I apologize. And I was like, oh my gosh, Kirk, romantic character growth.
Yeah. I don't think that's in character.
That's true. It was really entertaining. One thing we were like, you could see the three of us were cringing every time because we're like, that's not right. Was they had a tertiary like Nurse Chapel and Dr. McCoy. Like, why won't you say that you like her? Why won't she say that she likes him thing the whole time? And we're like, this is not right. She's in love with Spock. Why are they doing this? This is weird. And then like somewhere about after the beginning of Act Two, they're like, well, yeah, I remember. At least they acknowledged it and they moved on.
Yeah. You cut out. I didn't hear a thing there. You're talking about Nurse Chapel and then you cut out. Are you still there? Or are you dropped?
A little.
Da, da, da.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Now you are returned. Shall you try again? And you're gone.
And I'm definitely not muted now.
All right. You're back. Are you going to stay back or are you?
And now.
Technical.
Well, now you're frozen.
Difficulties.
I'm going to keep talking.
All right.
Until you tell me you can hear me.
I can hear you just fine. So why don't you start over with the Nurse Chapel story?
So Nurse Chapel and McCoy, they did an additional relationship storyline with them being humming and hawing about admitting that they like each other, which we were cringing at because that we're like, that's not right. She's in love with Spock, which they eventually mentioned. As soon as they mentioned that as like an aside, when she talks to the professor, the Andorian is like, oh yeah, I remember when I had a crush on Spock, you should totally go for it, but good luck. You're going to need it. And I'm like, okay. All right. Well, they acknowledged at the least that they brought it back around to canon. And right towards the end, when they go on the dangerous away team mission, the Andorian runs over to Spock and gives him a big kiss. And that's the first time they kind of admit each other that they like each other. And they're like, yes. And then as they're getting on the pad, McCoy says, why Spock? I didn't know you had it in you. And Spock's like, had what, doctor? And then as this is happening, Nurse Chapel from the opposite side of the stage charges through all of the people, like pushing people aside, like, wait, you can't leave yet. We're not doing this. You got to tell me right now. And she grabs McCoy off the transporter pad. We can't keep doing this. Do you like me or not? Yes. Do you like me? Yes. Okay, good. And then they awkwardly go to hug, but then the other one's trying to handshake, and then they verse, you know, oh wait, no, I'm gonna do that. And then he eventually fist bumps her. He's like, okay, I'll see you when I get back. And it's very awkward and kind of entertaining. And he goes and gets on the transporter pad, and there's a moment, and then Spock says, why doctor? I didn't know you had it in you. And right on top, he goes, shut up, Spock. So that's been our exchange. That it was pretty, it had a pretty good sense of humor. It was pretty well done. So definitely worth the drive up. And like I said, we got some signatures. I talked to the creators for a little bit afterward, one of whom was actually played Spock. They were very gracious and thankful for and happy to talk about it, which was really cool. And all the cast was hanging out outside as well. So it sounds like they had a great time and we had a great time seeing it. I'm going to keep bugging them, hopefully for a soundtrack, because I really enjoyed the music and I would like to hear some of it again.
Right on. It kind of reminds me of back when Warp 11 was playing at places where we might have been able to go to, how I kind of wanted to go but kind of didn't want to go because it could have been awful.
Right. Like, do we want to go all that way and then have it be terrible and then have to come all the way back having had a terrible experience? But this was only Pasadena, so You know, it was far, but it wasn't like Santa Barbara far, because we were talking about that. You know, we like so far to Santa Barbara to play cards, and they mostly only play 2E, so it's even worse. And then having to come home if it's a bad experience. But I think we were pretty confident with the company that we had that at least it would be fun, a fun road trip. So, and like I had brought my mix CDs, Star Trek mixes for the drive up, and we listened to those, and I was going to put, and I didn't even remember to put them on for the drive back. We had the radio off the whole time, 'cause we were talking about the show all the way back.
Oh, it sounds like an excellent time. If they do make a audio track, I would imagine it would be something that people could get a hold of somehow, eventually.
Yeah, I will definitely bring it up if that's something. That's not terribly likely, given that it was a pair show. I was impressive just given their proximity to LA and CBS and. You know, Viacom and Paramount, that they were able to get away with it. I guess, I don't know, through connections or just being, you know, a nonprofit stage performance for 2 weekends, you know, at a university, it was not, you know, a target. So it's the stage performances are a lot easier to pull off and then have go away than something that can be stick around like a recording. But I'm going to keep my fingers crossed because I'd really like to do it. And it was a unique that made for a unique environment for it, because it wasn't just the students. You know, there are undergrads, graduate students. It was a community members, JPL members who had come over because that they are, you know, part of Caltech, but also kind of part of NASA, and so like. You know, and I'm going to forget his name, Bobek, the Mohawk NASA guy.
Sure, yeah.
He was there. He was in the audience. And, he knew people who were in the cast. I was going to talk to somebody, and he had got to them first and was introducing them to his friends and was like, okay. I mean, it totally makes sense, but I just was not expecting that. And, yeah, just looking through this is like, okay, there's a couple faculty members. And some community members and at least 3 people from JPL. And I mentioned that the director was the Admiral, but the Admiral was actually a rotating role with another guy who was a JPL, control room engineer, a fairly well-known one, and Robert Picardo.
Well, that would have been amazing.
Who apparently came and did it once.
That's hilarious.
At least once. So that, you know, 3 people in 6 shows. So maybe they each did it twice. I'm not sure, but they all did it at least once. So that's, you know, kind of hilarious. And we go see that and have, you know, him pop up on the screen. Would have been unexpected and hilarious.
Yeah. All right. Well, awesome. Sounds like you had a great time. it sounds like the kind of thing that they probably wouldn't do again ever. You did something similar, but then you did it again later. So
yes,
did they have any intention of bringing it back again?
Well, I mean, if it's anything like our experience, you do it. Right now, they're focusing on getting through doing it the first time, and I mean. They did the same thing. As soon as I heard about it, the people I was trying to get to go with me, I told everybody about it. It's like, okay, we need to think about doing this, but if we're going to do it, we need to buy tickets now because it's in a week and a half and it's going to sell out. Because when we did it, every show sold out and we were always turning people away. There was always people who were sad who tried to come the day of, and this was no exception. We got there. In fact, we hit some pretty bad traffic and we only just got there about 3 minutes before curtain. And I was kind of afraid they might have been trying to sell our tickets to other people who were trying to get in, you know, waiting for cancellations or whatnot. So we managed to get there and get in, but they sold out every performance. So, you know, if they have more, if they want to do it again, You know, I'm sure that that's something they'll probably talk about if it was, you know, it was because it was so successful. I don't know. Usually, if you're going to do it again, something has to be something has to have changed or be different. I don't know if they get a different, a bigger space so they could hold more people and have bigger performances or have more performances. Somebody on their Facebook page replied, "Hey, this was great. Thanks for, I can't wait to see Boldly Go the Next Generation," which, you know, if they've already working on that, or if they, you know, decide to start working on that, maybe they'll come back for that, but you know, who knows? I'm definitely going to keep tabs on their group online though. And you know, if it comes back at begin, I'll go again and I'll let everybody know about it.
All right. Sounds good. Well, shall we move on to the opposite end of the spectrum?
Oh, yes. When we got these, I managed to get an extra. So this will be a prize at our second edition regional in Ryza. So if you are a fan of androids and would like a signed Bruce Maddox for your deck, you should come play in our regional.
And when is that? Do you know offhand?
Not yet. But... likely in June.
Okay. For some reason, I see the second. I see the first edition of the Tribbles. But
yeah, I know we put in for that because we wanted to get it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I don't see second edition on here. All right, very good. Well, then it shall be a prize, or if I'm sure that will happen. Brilliant. We both experienced a different Star Trek media. and that was the animated series, How Sharper Than a Serpent's Tooth. So you saw this 2 weeks ago, and I watched it over the weekend. I can't say that I hated it, but man, this was just a weird, weird episode. Really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it had strains again of other episodes, both past and future. So it's kind of one of those where, like, you know, this is clearly on the right Star Trek track. You know, it feels a little bit too much like Who Mourns for Adonis.
Very much so. Yeah.
There was a sort of a feeling of Star Trek IV. Or, you know, oh, you know, I expected you to do this thing and, you know, you never did it. And so I'm coming back to find out why you didn't do it instead of, you know, talking to the whales.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that.
But yeah.
Yeah.
It was a little heavy handed and disjointed.
I thought it was interesting. They were in the city when Kirk was up on top and he kind of solved a little puzzle. And you know, I thought that was kind of different. But the big floating snake guy with the wings, I'm reading the article on Memory Alpha that apparently William Shatner kept pronouncing wrong the whole time, but I'm not even gonna try. Kukulkan. All right.
Well, it was most, noticeable because it's like, oh, hey, they could have a Native American helmsman or navigator. That's cool. And then I, you know, briefly is like, well, this is only going to be happening because of plot, isn't it? And then it did. And then every time he said it was clearly correct. And then Kirk would say it a completely different way. It's like, he just told you how to say it. Stop crapping on his culture.
Stop
shatting on his culture.
No. All right. Well, this is another one that they probably couldn't have done very well if it were a real, you know, a live action. So
yeah,
I guess it fits the animated well. It certainly had a lot of color. Yikes. That crazy. All right. The power cat was kind of interesting. The electric eel cat creature. Okay.
That was a little bizarre. But interesting.
That's science fiction-y. I can see that.
Yeah. And I did like the sort of concept that kind of came back, reminiscent of Stargate and a little bit of Who Mourns for Adonis in that, you know, or I guess Thor was very Asgardian, where the, you know, the gods or mythological creatures of human past were, you know, just science that we, you know, was too advanced for us to understand yet, so it looked magical. Or, you know, these creatures were so advanced that they were godlike to us. Godlike.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting theme. Certainly one that they would play the opposite way, where, you know, the crew beams down and everyone thinks they're magical gods, right?
Right.
It just ended abruptly when the creature just kind of says, all right, fair enough, I'm out.
Yeah, it was very abrupt.
It's just...
I see your point. All right, see ya.
Yeah, we'll fly away now, and then you'll never see us or hear from us again. I don't know. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it. We only have one episode left. Do you think the last episode is going to be better or worse than this? This is something we should have done every time, all right? Every episode.
What's the over-under on it being over or under?
Yeah.
Well, you know, every time I would have bet under, so...
really, you know, even at the depths that we've been through?
It can't get any worse than this. Oh, God.
I don't know.
Well, you know, the last episode of the original series was probably one of the worst, so... you know, who knows? You know, this one, again, is sort of that representative of that middle ground, that kind of, this was not terrible, but it wasn't really very good, and it wasn't very interesting. There were some concepts that, you know, there were glimmers of hope that never did more than glimmer. And so, you know, this is kind of the par for the course. So this is about what I expect from the final episode.
All right. The last episode is called The Counterclock Incident. It is, I'm going to guess, a time travel-y thing. And, you know, I think there was an episode that I read something about a long time ago, and I don't think we've seen it yet. I think this is it, and I'm prepared to be super disappointed. Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I just clicked on the picture, on the next article, and... I'm already out. This is going to be awful. All right.
Well, it's one more week, so.
It's one more week. I've got, and like I said, I've got an idea of something to do after this, and it's going to be just as bad, I'm sure. But we'll get through this. We'll talk about it as a whole. We'll do that next week.
Yeah.
We'll have a tournament report next week as well, right?
Correct. We will have 1E OTF constructed. How's that for a segue for you?
1E OTF constructed. So you'll have some new rules to play with.
We will indeed.
Mostly.
Well, you know, certainly for our group, I don't think it's going to be much different, because most of us play with these ref cards anyway. You know, Thomas, I think he's recent, the last several tournaments, he's sort of foregone ref cards on principle, but you know,
I think for the most part everyone in our group, maybe with the exception of Thomas, not only plays with them but also plans around them, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think anybody expects to not see those cards, so it's not really, you know, if you're playing OTF, you should expect to see those cards. It's not a big surprise. In fact I think the interesting part about it, and was a good design choice, was the sort of variation with You Are a Monument. Because if I'm playing Delta Quadrant and you're playing Delta Quadrant, well, then the odds are even. There's really no need for us to have to throw out, okay, well, we're going to play to 140 just because, you know, no, we don't need the Elf Quadrant mission because we're doing that. So, you know, now the Mirror versus Gamma or versus Delta or Gamma versus Delta, that's kind of another question, but there's really not a way to.
Yeah,
from that card.
The idea back when TNG came out was we wanted to make people play in the Alpha Quadrant. The Alpha Quadrant was where all the shows were for the most part, with the exception of Voyager. But I don't think there's an argument that wasn't a terrible downswing in the game when Voyager came out. But the idea that at least the problem being if you can play in your own quadrant by yourself, then that minimizes any kind of interaction. Some people don't like interaction. Some people like interaction. But if you're in your own quadrant and not coming to the Alpha Quadrant, then you are completely eliminating the possibility of interaction other than, you know, the seed phase where we play dilemmas. Whereas
right.
if we make some incentive for players to go to the Alpha Quadrant, now everyone has to have at least one mission that they would come to and do. But if you're going to do one mission, you probably ought to do two missions so you know your opponent can't just pile up in one spot. So the idea of making kind of balancing the playing field between the affiliations that only play in the Alpha Quadrant and want to have some interactions and the other affiliations that could potentially play in their own quadrant by themselves, that was the genesis of the idea. Clearly it's worked over the last number of years, right? Number 4 years or so.
Yeah.
You make an interesting point that there was some talk about if I'm playing Delta Quadrant, I've got that chance that my opponent isn't playing with you or a monument. And, if you're counting on your opponent, you know, being a terrible player, then how does that reflect on you? I mean, obviously, you build a deck to plan for that card, or you've made a poor deck. The interesting thing that you mentioned a second ago was Delta versus Mirror. Now that we'll be getting a lot more Mirror Quadrant missions, and you could probably do the same thing had this card not been in the pool that you could with Delta back in the day, and just play Mirror Quadrant by itself. Well, the reason we were able to put all those cards in there, all those extra mirror missions, is because we've got this card that forces you to either get 40 extra points, which is, you know, realistically another mission, or play a bit in the Alpha Quadrant. The Delta versus Mirror, since the way the rule is set up, if neither player is playing Alpha Quadrant, you don't have to worry about the extra 40 points. That's an interesting conundrum. I don't think that came up in any of our testing or our discussions. That's still a huge benefit for the Delta Quadrant, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think the answer is, if the Delta Quadrant player is hoping not to get around that and hoping to play against another single quadrant player, all the Mirror Quadrant person has to do is put in an Alpha Quadrant mission, and then suddenly the Mirror Quadrant person has an out, so they only have to get to 100 points, and the Delta Quadrant person, if they weren't planning for it, then it's perfect. They're hosed, as they should be, to have to go to an extra 40 points. Whereas if the Delta Quadrant player is playing with an Alpha Quadrant mission, then they know they're either going to have to go to 140, staying in the Delta Quadrant, or they'll have that outlet to go to the Alpha Quadrant. I think that's how most people have been playing. I can't imagine because people have been complaining about it on the boards, but that's just that's madness to me. So I think between the two, General Quarters was designed to slow things down a bit, and I think that hit the Mirror Quadrant pretty hard. I'm surprised that we didn't get more complaints about that. But the UR Monument is honestly what's allowed so much of this extra mirror stuff to take place. We certainly wouldn't have made any extra missions had they not been there. And codifying the rules just makes it one less, you know, gotcha moment for, you know, anybody, really.
Yeah, I mean those are both game balancing rules, and I can't imagine there being such a resurgence in the game without those, particularly trying to encourage play in the Alpha Quadrant. I know TNG was overpowered when it came out the continuing mission, but there were several different decks you could play, and you could play those, which was a little bit like Delta, but even with that powered down now, I really don't see there, you know, oh, like we really want to try to play with these original affiliations again, but why would I do that when I'm just going to get pummeled by all of these Voyager decks? And without those two throttle cards, that really became the equalizer to level that playing field, that I do not see there being the resurgence that we've had in those last few years. I think those have really been an impetus for saving and restoring this game.
Yeah, sure. I think it's been nothing but a boon. There's been some talk on the boards about other potential changes. I think one was put out jokingly of villagers with torches. Villagers with torches have been around for a very long time, and the question was, should that be a rule in OTF? And you know, I think that the meta around the decision to redshirt or not is so different than the other things that we've been talking about that I don't follow it. I mean, I made a post discussing what it could look like, but I just don't think that's something we need to do. I mean, there's so many other things, so many dilemmas that we've put out that really hurt you bad for redshirting. Civil War doesn't allow you to redshirt at all, even in space, which I think is, you know, that's the kind of thing that for that problem, I think that's a better solution. The kind of, you know, the self-policing thing where you're willing to get this benefit by playing, you know, with these restrictions. I think that's a better fit for something like that.
Well, I mean, in general, I've always been a proponent of just making these rules so we don't have to deal with ref cards. I mean, that we continue to have ongoing issues with ref guards being used for not defensive purposes. And there's not really anything with villagers with torches that I can think of off the top of my head, but I think the thing with that card is a bit like what we were talking about last week with security drills and OT Kirk, which is the threat of it is much more powerful than its actual play. Like, I don't remember the last time I've had to pull it out. But I was just talking with somebody about their deck, and you know, the deck I borrowed from Calm Decker, and he's like, "Well, I used the other tent because I want to give myself the option of redshirting in space." So it's still an issue, and it's still out there. And I'm sure if there weren't villagers with torches, he would be using that to redshirt on the planet as well. So it's just, you know, I still am a proponent of wrapping those in. So I'm thrilled to see another couple of rough cards come off the list and just become rules. I know some people are like, well, we're going to be just too many rules and too many things to remember, but you already remember all of these things because you have to worry about them as ref cards, you know, whether or not they're going to come out. If they're just rules, then you don't even have to worry about whether or not they're going to come out. You just know that those rules are in effect and they're part of the game. And if you don't like those rules, that's what open is for.
Well, the problem with that theory is as we errata more and more cards, then they are errated for all formats. So one of the conundrums that we have as you know, someone trying to decide what we're going to do is I very much don't like, you know, having this pile of ref cards to take around in every deck I play with. Right. We want to get as many of them out as we need it. So, I mean, would I rather play a deck without villagers with torches in it? Because I know that you can't attempt with less than three people. Yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, that certainly would make it easier for deck building, but On the other hand, if we were to take all of the cards that are ref cards and go along the path of making them irrelevant because the cards that they nullify don't exist anymore or are fixed, like take for example Rogue Borg Mercenaries. If we come back and make an errata to Rogue Borg Mercenaries, and I know there have been dozens that have been suggested, some close to the original, you know, intent of the card, where you take over a ship, some vastly different, you know, to download a non-Borg drone to hand, right? Just vastly different things. If we go that way to fix and get rid of ref cards, then we're not just changing OTF, we're changing open as well. And so you can't say, well, just go play open, because now we've gotten rid of that element. And as much as I don't agree with it, some people really enjoy playing with things like Rogue Borg Mercenaries, where you just ping your opponent to death. I'm not above it. I certainly played it back in the day once or twice.
Well, I'm not suggesting going through and eroding all the cards. I'm talking about eliminating the need for ref cards because the ref cards are rules.
Right, but
that won't affect Rogue Borg Mercenaries because that would either be on the OTF ban list, in which case you can't play with it in OTF and you can play with it in open, or there would be some kind of OTF rule that would take the place of whatever the ref card is that affects it, that would then you can play with it, but it's going to be affected by this OTF rule, but only in OTF, and then it's still usable in open.
I think that's a great idea, but there is another faction, and again, we're not going to be able to please anybody, but sorry, everybody. I think I said anybody, which is funny.
Well, you can't do that
sometimes
only when you're
like
trying to please everybody.
Yeah, that says, you know, the OTF ban list should be reduced to as few cards as possible, and I if I'm not mistaken, there's a few that should be coming up soon that'll be coming off the list in time for regional season, which should be great. That'll be huge. But we can't have both. We can't say, okay, it's banned in OTF, so we don't have to worry about it. Now you don't have to use a ref card. And let's take as many cards off the ban list as possible. There's just so many different paths that everyone seems to want to go in different directions, and we can only do so many. So I think we're going to probably end up, you know, somewhere in the middle, where hopefully the most active players and the most, you know, players who keep playing are at least happy enough to continue. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is this is a change, and, you know, I might have to change the way I put together some of my decks.
Well, that sounds like, and I could say this without bias, because I really genuinely don't know who specifically is in charge of doing that, but the many cooks wanting to go in different directions sounds like a leadership problem. So either, because I know there are this group trying to do this, and this group trying to do this, and this group trying to do this, but I'm pretty sure they all report to a brand manager or a design manager or something, and that person needs to come up with a unifying decision and go for it, because, you know, otherwise you're going to, you can go so far and either, you know, at best you accomplish little or nothing with people pulling in different directions. At worst, you start drawing and quartering the game.
Yeah. And it's, I can't argue with that too much. I mean, this change was ready to go in October, and we just kind of kept punting the ball down the field. And the reason it went up without much of an article, a very short article, is that we needed to get something up before regional season was upon us, and this is not the kind of change we could make between when regional starts and when Worlds ends. It's got to be in this little, you know, pocket of time, you know, preferably in the middle of the winter, when, you know, you're in the middle of leagues and you're playing, you know, testing new stuff out, getting ready. I even think this is too close to regionals. I would have rather done it, you know, in January or February, maybe with a bit more descriptive article to go with it. But And I'll take some responsibility for that because I've been pushing for this from behind the scenes and didn't actually write the article. I could have taken a little bit more on that. But, I think it's something that we've needed to push through for a while, and I'm glad it's finally done, and I'm looking forward to moving on and going up from here. I'm actually looking forward to seeing what comes off, if anything comes off the ban list in the next few days to accompany this.
Cool. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to this being included, and I don't see it having any major effect on our particular environment, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how it affects other people as we move into regional season.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of some negatives that would come through from this. There's going to be a little bit, since it was a small change to how scoring works now. It's no longer now I'm confused because we've gone back and forth so many times on this. The rules went back to the original, back in the day, intermix ratio. If you have more bonus points than non-bonus points, the excess don't count toward winning. So it's going to take a little. This is I'm reasonably certain this was in the rules at some point back when we were testing OTF, and it's codified now because of how the victory conditions had to be changed. But so now, if you are scoring an event, now previously we've really gone back and forth on how to score. If I've got 50 bonus points and 25 mission points, and you get 100 points and win, how does that score get reported? Is it 100 to 75 or is it 100 to 50? Because my points are still points. I have them, but they don't count toward winning. But do they count towards scoring differential? I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. I don't remember. We've done it back and forth so many different ways. I don't remember how we did it when we were doing it right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that wording is so bizarre. That's always been a problem since it came out, of that wording being an issue. And I don't know why we haven't just changed that wording.
Well,
instead of trying to reinterpret what it means.
So there was a reason, and I'll have to look in the notes over the last 4 years to figure out why. It went from, and now I got to look to see what it was before.
Yeah. Because I know at one point I actually I lost like 15 points playing like Quinns and other like recruit mercenaries because, these points don't count towards winning, but I still have them. So I've lost these points that I don't really care that I lose or not. And then, ended up using them to win the game.
Yeah, I'll have to look, and I can't pull it up here quickly. But it's going to take some time to figure out how to do scoring correctly again, and I just remember it being confusing. So we'll see how that goes.
All right, well, we'll give it a test run this weekend, and we'll see how it works out.
But
we'll talk about it next week.
That's what OTF is for, right? I mean, if there's something wrong, it's rules that we can change. It's not a permanent document.
Right. And it's not a card that we have to errata, which is always a pain.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Very good. Anything else we want to discuss tonight?
No, I think that's it. And I think that's been a lot. So I think we can look forward to getting a report on how that works out from next week's tournament.
I look forward to hearing about it. I have a baseball game in the middle of the day. So had we been playing in the normal 3 o'clock time, I wouldn't be able to make it out, but I'm not going to be able to make it. It's going to be the second baseball game of the year, so I can't miss that. Let me know how it goes.
All right, will do. Good luck with the baseball game, and we'll text you for triples if that becomes a possibility.
Triple sounds good. Let me know when you guys wrap up.
All right. Well, that's just about all of the intelligence we have this week. You can turn in next week for our tournament retort, our OTF update, and the animated series finale. In the meantime, I am Sir Rogue.
And I'm Sir Dan.
And I will remind you all to expand your musical in the universe.
And I will draw that. You cannot run. You cannot hide. And you cannot defect. Okay.
They are always watching you, but you can't.